Today's podcast is brought to you by LBH PR Co., a boutique public relations and communications agency promoting the products and stories of burgeoning lifestyle brands and notable entrepreneurs. Launched in 2013 by Lauren Hopkins, LBH is a skilled team of devoted publicists with seasoned industry expertise, genuine connections, and a true passion for client success. Their thoughtful approach and meaningful outreach campaigns cultivate impactful media, influencer, and brand relations to deliver results and position clients for long-term success, with a focus on a personable rapport, polished communications, and memorable moments. LBH makes a PR investment worthwhile. Follow them on Instagram at LBHPRCo, online at www.lbhprco.com, or connect with the team by emailing hello@lbhprco.com. Thank you so much, ladies, for sponsoring. Hi, everyone. I am Emily Landers, and this is How'd She Do That? A podcast answering that question each episode. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to today's episode of the podcast. I'm so happy that you're here. And if this is your first time listening, I want to extend a very special welcome to you. This podcast has been up and running for 2 years now. We have over 160 episodes for you to enjoy, including today's conversation with Red Clay Hot Sauce founder, as well as Babyator's founder, Molly Feening. But before we dive into this incredibly encouraging conversation, I want to give you all a little bit of an inside scoop as to what's happening here at HSDT. For those of you who have been listening for some time, you'll know that this was a passion project that very quickly became my favorite thing, and we are looking to build and grow, and boy, have we done just that. Last week was a huge week for the podcast. If you guys aren't following us over on Instagram, at How'd She Do That Podcast, go ahead and join the fun. Last week was a really, really big week for us over there, and it's been so fun to hear how much you guys are enjoying our summer series with Liza Pruitt. Liza is an online art gallery owner, and we've been interviewing her artist in preparation for a group show launching August 24th. I hope you guys are ready to enjoy some beautiful artwork, some beautiful photography. I know it's been brightening the end of summer for me to share those conversations with you. And lastly, you guys, we continue to have such great feedback around the Emily updates that we have shared previously on Friday bonus episodes, where I pull back the curtains of my hopes and dreams and expectations for the podcast. We even get into the weeds of what mic I use and lots of different details there. Well, I'm so excited to share that all of the behind the scenes is finally here over on patreon.com/howdshedothat. We are so excited about our channel and the content that we are preparing for you all over there. It's just so many more details, so much more than I would share likely on a podcast or have time to share. And the feedback has been incredible. So thank you guys so much for joining us over on Patreon. Again, that's patreon.com/howdshedothat. So we will talk to you over there. But until then, enjoy today's conversation. Here is Molly Feening on How'd She Do That? Today's guest, Molly Feening, is the co-founder and CEO of Red Clay Hot Sauce, a modern Southern hot sauce company based in Charleston, South Carolina. Upon graduating from Harvard University with a BA in electrical engineering and computer science, Molly joined the corporate world, and her husband Ted became a Marine Corps fighter pilot. During the season of life, Molly co-founded Babyators, the leading sunglasses brand for babies and kids. When Molly isn't creating new product launches for Red Clay Hot Sauce, traveling, or encouraging other female entrepreneurs, she is likely spending time in Charleston with her close group of girlfriends, her husband Ted, and their two wonderful boys, Sawyer and Fox. Molly, welcome to How'd She Do That?
Thank you, Emily. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, well, I have been very much excited about this conversation. I have quite a few listeners who are eager to hear it as well. So thank you so much. Thank you for joining me.
It's such an honor. And I've, you know, long admired the podcast. So I'm so thrilled to be a guest.
Well, thank you. And it was so fun to briefly meet you in Georgia. I'm sure we will overlap again, but this is such a treat to be able to share your story. And I have to admit, as I'm looking into you, before we started recording, I'm like, wait, what? So there's so many different entities to unpack. And I want to start from the beginning. How about you tell us, and I want to hear from you, tell us, where did you go to school? And ultimately, what made you decide to, get that major in electrical engineering and computer science?
Well, I grew up in New York City, went to an all-girls Catholic school my entire life, 15 years, which I loved, called Sacred Heart, and then went up to Cambridge and studied at Harvard for college. And I had a sort of a joint major in electrical engineering, computer science, which is a little bit of hardware, a little bit of software, and loved it. Loved what it taught me about problem solving and sort of algorithmic thinking and attacking things that seem really daunting with baby steps. So it was, even though the code I learned, you know, now 20 years ago is outdated, the mindset I still use even, you know, in my non-tech kind of business day to day.
Well, it's amazing. And I'm sure many times when people are talking to you, they want to hear a little bit more about that route to Harvard. At what point did you think, you know, that's where I want to go to college? And where was the excitement in that at maybe that age?
I was talking about that actually with some girlfriends last week. So my father attended the law school there.
Okay.
And I want to say I joined him for a reunion, for his law school reunion, well, probably when I was in eighth grade, seventh grade. And as part of that, my parents actually one summer kind of took me on a little road trip tour. I think we were going to visit DC for some historical sites and the museums and such. But on the way, stopped at Georgetown, stopped at Yale, stopped at BC, stopped at Harvard.
Yep.
I even think we went down to UVA. But one summer, right before my seventh, eighth grade, did a little visit to a couple schools. Just to sort of kind of get me excited and just, you know, I think thinking about the kind of place I'd like to be at before high school even started, which I think is super smart. And I plan to do the same thing with our boys.
Yeah.
So you're just thinking kind of more holistically as you enter those years where, you know, all of this is part of the package. You're presenting yourself as sort of a whole being to be to the schools. And for me, Harvard just had that. I also looked at MIT because I love tech as well, but Harvard had a little bit more of that well-roundedness where, you know, what I love about Harvard is they're really thoughtful about diversity of student. And so they care about musicians and athletes and, you know, poets and techies. Mm. And it's, you know, they could fill a class with 1600 on their SATs, but they purposefully don't. They really want a well-rounded student body. And I gravitate towards that as well because I have all these different aspects of my personality. And so while I went to MIT and arguably could have gotten as good as, if not better, of a tech education there, I really loved that I could minor in French and all my college roommates were social studies or literature majors. Mm. And it wasn't so sciencey. And you know, it did also have that beautiful red brick, you know, ivy climbing up the walls, fall foliage, just sort of like fantasy college that I had always had in my head of what I wanted as a campus.
Oh my gosh. Well, it's so cool. And it's too cool to not just touch on briefly and think about and to think about you. Yeah. Seventh, eighth grade, brainstorming, dreaming, thinking, where could I go? What could this look like? And props to your parents for kind of considering that. And for those who are listening, perhaps that's something you might want to do.
Because then when you're told by your parents after school, you know, it's time to go do your homework. You've got something with a goal, you know, a reason for doing it. It's not, oh, mom, I'm annoyed. It's, oh, I want to learn and I want this opportunity for myself and I'm taking the steps to get it.
Oh my gosh. Well, I love it. Very, very cool. Now, tell us this. What did you ultimately do? I mean, I mentioned a little bit in the intro, but you graduate and what are you hoping to step into and what do you ultimately step into post-grad? What was that first role?
My first role right out of school was at IBM and I went to work there. to sort of help launch what they called their global services division at the time, which was their first foray into sort of the human bridge between tech and their client businesses. And so almost sort of like a strategic consulting division. Uh-huh. And I advised a big financial client called Standard & Poor's on updating their credit rating system. But my role really, and I think a role I play consistently in life, I've kind of noticed is sort of a bridge between kind of two different groups that might not be able to communicate as effectively. And so you had these, you know, hardcore coders who didn't want to go kind of sit in the office and learn about the system and spend hours talking about what to build and what the needs were and what worked and what didn't. And then you had the business clients that didn't really understand the way that the tech worked necessarily. And so my team and I kind of helped translate that. And I really enjoyed that role. Though my dream had always been as a child, I either wanted to be a wizard or a spy, and I didn't have magical powers. And so I always had sights on kind of going to DC and joining the intelligence community. And so after about a year at IBM, that inkling still sat kind of in my belly, and I left to go pursue that avenue and went back to Harvard for a year just to work on an international securities project, studying the role of how, you know, at the time Islamist extremism was mobilizing in Europe, but that took me to DC to officially kind of do the work. And that is where I re-met my husband, who went to college with me. And there was my first big pivot in life.
Oh my gosh. Okay. You continue to become the most interesting woman in the room. This is too much fun.
So crazy. I mean,
well, I'm waiting. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I'm ready for you to take down the bad guys. I'm like, this is amazing. So, but you just mentioned something really cool. You actually reconnected with your husband at that role. Mm-hmm. How did that work? Was that out and about, or was that actually in work?
So we went to college together and never dated undergrad. And he graduated right after 9/11, or before 9/11, rather, that June. And then a few months into working, the tragedy happened. And a day later, he enlisted in the Marine Corps as a fighter pilot to help serve the nation. And so he had been flying all over the South training in this jet. And I moved to DC. And our first weekend there, my first weekend there, rather, a common friend of ours had a party in Georgetown at his parents' house, and I was 25 at the time, and went to that and re-met him at the party. So he had flown up to see his friends. It was a film screening of his friend's documentary. So he came up to watch the movie. I was just invited as a newbie in DC, and we ended up talking all night. And as opposed to taking that role in intelligence, 4 months later, I was a military fiancé at a rural base in Mississippi, and did not have any kind of that tech corporate ladder or intelligence avenue available geographically. And so really had to kind of reevaluate what I wanted to do. For me, the great opportunity at that point was building a family and our love, and I wanted to pursue that first.
Well, it's amazing to think, because we hear your accolades, we know the direction that you could have been stepping into, but instead Ted comes along and you guys, for lack of better words, take flight together and head to Mississippi. And to think of this season of life, and you just said it so eloquently, to focus in on family and creating that love family and stepping into that season. But I'm curious, because I know there's a story here, and I know ultimately this is when entrepreneurship really comes into your life. You mm-hmm. are then stepping into a totally different world. You head to Mississippi. What did it look like for you to, make a life there, make friends? And how long were you guys there?
We sort of bebopped around all over the South for our first 3 years of marriage. We were in Mississippi a few months. We ended up moving to India for a month, where Ted proposed. Back to America and lived in Virginia Beach for a year with a training program he was in, and then down to Beaufort, South Carolina for 3 years. So I both never had thought I would live in the South, and then all of a sudden I've lived in 5 states in the South in my 3 years in America, and also Florida, Pensacola, Florida for a few months. But then secondly, never imagined myself kind of in that military wife role. In fact, half my friends and family and professors who were kind of interviewed as part of my security clearance thought this was all part of a cover. Like, yes, you left DC to wink, wink, become a military wife. And I was like, no, I did. They're like, that sounds exactly like you. That said, the military family is so wonderful, so loving, so supportive. So
yes,
it is a hard life. I don't like picking up and moving the way we did. That was not enjoyable for me, but it was certainly a learning lesson. It was, as you mentioned, the reason I became an entrepreneur, because I wanted to have something I could take with me and build a job, build a business for myself to stay stimulated. And that is the, in addition to sort of Ted and our family, clearly, I know I'm meant to be an entrepreneur, and that is the avenue in which it unfolded. But I do want to say that the reason what makes up for it is how loving kind of all the military wives are and the squadrons. And there's just this sense of camaraderie because they get it, right? It's a really unique life. You support one another really deeply, and specifically the wives when the husbands are gone. It's just a really wonderful community.
Absolutely. And please take a moment later to thank Ted on behalf of all of us for his service. It's really something to hear that that's a part of your story. Well, tell us this, because you step into entrepreneurship in a really unique way. Mm-hmm. And I would love to know, as you're there, because ultimately we know Baby Eaters comes to fruition during the season of life, but are you actively thinking of ideas for a business at this time, or was Baby Eaters what made you think, I can't not do this?
I knew I wanted to do something.
Okay.
I knew we were moving every 3 to 6 to 18 months, depending on the role and the location. And so I knew I couldn't necessarily set down roots somewhere and keep a job.
Right.
And so I was looking for things that I could kind of pick up and go. You see a lot of military wives who want to work, they end up being teachers, nurses, physical trainers, physical therapists, because you can kind of plug and play in any community, right? Mm-hmm. But for me, I grew up, my dad was in commercial real estate and hotel investment banking. And so that was a world I knew growing up watching him. Mm. So I started it was also the beginning of the Great Recession in 2008-09. And so there was a lot of cheap real estate.
Mm.
And so I actually started using kind of family savings that I had received from grandparents and parents, and my husband kind of pooled what he had. And we started buying a number of 3 or 4 commercial real estate buildings and managing those at auction. That was the first time I kind of worked for myself, but it was nice capital and it was nice sort of long-term investment strategy, but I did not enjoy the day-to-day of the work. I did not enjoy the industry very much. And so that I quickly kind of was still looking elsewhere. And my husband was an aviator for the Marine Corps. And the tradition when the guys go out and train somewhere, either a short training program, which is like a couple months long, called what they call a DET, or a longer deployment, 6, 7, 8 months, as they come back in and they fly in formation, they taxi up to the hangar. The families are allowed to stand right on the flight line and watch the jets. Wow. And they pop it open, and the kids run up to their dads and moms, and it's just this really beautiful, sweet tradition. And what I was doing that after Ted was gone a few months, and watching these kids run, looking for their parents in the sky and the jets. And we all, the adults all had shades on, and the parent and the kids were squinting. I can't see, my eyes hurt. I mentioned that to Ted. Isn't that funny that like the aviators all have their aviators on, like the military issues them, classic shades to protect their eyes, and the kids can't see. And he's like, well, we should make them and call them Baby-Aviators for a baby aviator. And I laughed, and I loved the name instantly. And our college friends who were consultants in Atlanta, one at McKinsey, one at Bain, both were looking to do something a little different because their schedules had them flying on 2 different planes halfway across the country every week, and they never got to see each other. And so they knew one of them had to leave, if they were going to ever get to have a dinner together. And so we called them up and we're like, we know you were talking about doing something different. What do you think of this? And being business consultants, they said, well, let's do a market analysis. And so we did a full 1,000-person, 1,000-mom market survey of the children's sunglasses market once before we even thought about anything else, just very much data-driven business, but other than obviously kind of the name that, that makes you laugh. And learned that there was this gap in the market between the sort of impulse buy at the checkout counter junky shades with the, you know, SpongeBob SquarePants on the side and luxury Gucci Juniors that were a couple $100. Yeah. And we learned also that they parents wanted something durable. Parents didn't want to spend money if they were going to lose things. And we actually built our business model around the data we learned from that first survey.
Oh my gosh. Well, it's so fun to hear the behind the scenes of what has been a very successful business and brand. Tell me this, how long, when did this launch? When did this start?
Babyators?
Yes.
2010.
Okay,
we crafted it, you know, and did the survey in 2010. We officially launched May 2011. And so it's been about a decade. 11 years now. And we've grown it to about 8 million in revenue. We've sold about 5 million pairs over the life of the business. We retail in thousands of doors, including Saks and Neiman's and Bye Bye Baby and Babies R Us before it closed. And obviously our website and Amazon sort of being two of our major channels.
Oh my gosh. Well, it's amazing. And I'm so curious too, because at this point you really are a serial entrepreneur. If you've started multiple businesses, and I'm so looking forward to diving into Red Clay Hot Sauce, which is totally different from Babyators, which I think it's so fun to connect the dots for folks who are listening of, oh, look at the many different entities that Molly has actually stepped into. But with Babyators, was there ever, did you ever think it would be as big and as successful as it is now?
Really early on. So we co-founded Babyators a year after one of our college friends actually started Warby Parker. We had dinner with him and we were like, you're disrupting the entire optical industry. I mean, you're making baby sunglasses, but what do you have to suggest that we can do to, you know, follow in your footsteps a little bit? And he was like, you know, from day one, make sure you invest in PR and earned media, not just paid media, and get the brand out there, tell the story through the right, print and TV, partners based on, who your customer is. And so that's something we started super scrappy, like I said, right at kind of after the Great Recession, 2010-ish. And so very thoughtful about spending cash, but where we did put money was hiring a PR firm. And, within a month we received our first hit on Newsweek, which was at the time still like a print magazine. And they included us in Essentials for Summer Roundup.
Oh, wow.
And instantly we had 5 or 10 stores call us and say, we want to carry you. And then a few months after that, Sarah Jessica Parker's twins were photographed in them. And we got a couple new celebrities really quickly. And one of my goals when I hired my PR firm, I said, I want to be on the Ellen DeGeneres show's big, Mother's Day giveaway. And she's like, that is going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. No way, not going to happen. And I was like, Sabrina, I know you can do it. I know you can do it. And about a year in, she calls me up and she's like, you're not going to believe it, but we got Ellen.
Oh, and my God.
I think that was the moment where I was like, okay, we're doing this.
Yes. Oh my gosh. And you wore, I'm sure, many hats in that whole experience. Are the original folks still involved? Everybody's still involved in Babyators?
The 4 co-founders are still involved. Obviously, our current team, we've had the same team now through COVID a couple of years. Some people have come and left and gone to business school and moved on, but the 4 co-founders are still co-CEO. We own 95 or 97% of the business. We have a portion of proceeds for, a board of advisors, but we've never taken outside capital. We've scaled organically through putting profits back into the business. Unlike Red Clay, which I'm happy to talk about, where we've done a couple capital raises because it's such a money intensive industry, grocery. Yeah. But, But this, you know, is a wonderful, the team runs a lot of the day-to-day, and we sort of serve as an advisory board available to them when they need us.
Oh my gosh. Well, it's amazing. It's so impressive, and it's so fun to hear really the beginning stages of your entrepreneurship journey, which has been insanely successful, Molly. But yes, Babyators takes you through this season of travel and really being in a lot of different locations. I think you can correct me if I'm wrong. And ultimately, at some point, you guys end up back in Charleston or in Charleston. So tell me a little bit about this path, because it does feel as though you are very much settled currently, and just would love to hear more.
No, yeah, we knew, you know, when Ted and I first met, I think one of our first couple weekends in, I had a wedding for a childhood girlfriend in Charleston, and he came as my date. And he grew up in South Carolina, about 2 hours north of here.
Oh, wow.
And I just fell in love with the city. He always wanted to live here. And we just knew we were going to raise our babies here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's such a blessing, you know, because through the process, I have living here just built this wonderful network of fellow female entrepreneurs and just incredibly close in my heart girlfriends that are a big part of my life and my well-being and our growth together and all the things. And I never knew that would be part of this city journey as well. I knew it was a great place for our boys to grow up. I knew that Ted and I, you know, both love the city and its amazing food and bev and the fact that it's on the water and you know, it's weather and it's, you know, a quick flight to New York so I can see my family very easily. But that the community of female creatives and business owners here is so powerful and so supportive and it's a big part of my life for sure. Mm.
Well, and it's so unique too. It encourages me to no end. Many of my girlfriends here are in Los Angeles, and it's kind of funny. I need to not branch out, but I need to find these kind of relationships that there are ladies who are, you know, founders or doing different things. And it's so cool to see. And many of you know that many of the ladies that Molly's chatting about and oftentimes I find some of them are listeners, which is really fun, but it's quite encouraging, even for me on the other coast, to see you guys encouraging each other and lifting one another up. Now, how long have you been in Charleston?
We moved here when Sawyer was about 18 months or two, so 2013.
Oh my gosh.
So,
okay.
9 years I've been here.
Well, so you've been a key part and instrumental in this group of female founders that you're with and that are such a huge part of your life. That's really fun to have a little bit of an inside scoop, because I know Charleston has seen such growth over the last few years. You mentioned Sawyer, who's about 18 months when you guys moved here in 2013. And then you're stepping into a new season at some point, it sounds like. And I am so curious to know what made you think you could have another business on your plate.
I mean, I never intended to be CEO of a hot sauce company for sure. I think it just sort of like evolved or pivoted in a really interesting way. Basically, you know, with our second son, Fox, this was 2015.
Okay.
All I wanted that entire pregnancy were oysters and dirty martinis, and I could have neither. And so our first date out after baby, my husband took me to our favorite oyster bar. And we had, you know, a dozen oysters and a martini together, and it was heaven and so fun. And the bartender came over and he said, "Well, do you want hot sauce with your oysters?" And I was not a hot sauce fan at the time, ironic in retrospect. And he's like, and the bartender sold me on it. He said, no, our chef makes it himself. He barrel ages it in his in his garage. It's not too hot. It's made to perfectly pair with oysters. And I was like, fine, Sean, I'd love to try it. Brought it over, tasted it, turned to my husband and said, "This is the best thing I've ever had. And I don't even like hot sauce. And this is the best thing I ever had." And also it kind of became this cult phenomenon in Charleston where it was in these little mini liquor bottles on the dozen oysters, and girlfriends would actually love it so much that clients would actually put it in their purse and take it home. And so they had to actually keep the caps off these little bottles when they put the hot sauce on the oyster tray, because they didn't want people pocketing it. So
that is so funny.
They could keep their hot sauce. So Ted went back into the kitchen, met Jeff, who's now my partner, and shook his hand and said, this is amazing. You know, we're in CPG. We know this world. We've built a business before. If you ever need any help, like give us a call. We'd love to advise. We were big fans. 2 weeks later, we had invested something like $10,000 or $15,000 and were silent capital and helped him get off the ground. And he would call us once in a while for a lawyer recommendation or an accountant recommendation or something like this. And Babyators at the time very much still needed me in the day to day. Box was a couple weeks old. Obviously, I was, you know, very active sort of with a newborn and a 4 year old. And so I didn't really think much of it other than Jeff was a wonderful guy, happy to be useful and somehow help build this business with him if I can to support. In 2018, 4 years later, Jeff had sort of the community of chefs around him really just obviously. What makes Red Clay different is the fact that it's created by a James Beard restaurant, you know, fine dining chef who's worked at some of the best restaurants, three of the best restaurants in Charleston and a number across the country, New York and Chicago as well. And it's about elevating your food, right? And so it's the balance of notes that you would bring to a beautiful plate, a beautiful dish at a restaurant. So sweet meats, salty meats, acid meats, heat meats, umami. He thinks about the quality ingredients locally sourced and how to craft it in a way that it's about nuance and balance and deliciousness and not just like slap you in the face with heat. right. Which, you know, that's not my hot sauce. You know, and even Cholula, I love Cholula, but whatever you put it on, it's going to taste like Cholula.
Yep.
So if you want to eat Cholula, great, put it on. But other times I actually want to taste the food. And even I remember New York Times, T Magazine did a review of Red Clay and the editor said, I use this as an ingredient in my cooking as much as I use it as a condiment after the fact to add flavor, to add umami, you know, in my stews, in my chili, in my soups. This was a winter review. He's like, I plan to use this all winter long. And he got it. That's exactly our customer, is the foodie, home cook chef who wants to have the premium version of something that's a little bit, it's about just beautiful, clean ingredients and delicious flavor. And so in 2018, I was reading an article about Sir Kensington's ketchup in some business magazine, or how it sold to Unilever for $140 million on $17 million gross revenue, a very insane exit multiple on top line, not even profit. And I called my friend who was a condiments CEO. He was in the keto paleo sauce company, and he now has a $30 million keto sauce company. And I called him and I said, is this legit? And he was like, yeah, we have these big entities like Kraft, McCormick, Kraft Heinz, McCormick, Kellogg, Unilever, that they, the way they expand into new product category is through acquisition. So they're willing to pay a really frothy multiple, much higher than I would ever see in Babyators. Babyators, you might get 2-3x top line, you know, with children's retail. Yep. And that piqued my interest because we really built Babyators to live on. We really built Babyators to make it a legacy brand and own it for years, and if not decades. And I really was excited about the journey to an exit and learning as a CEO how to prepare a business to sell it, to put it on a platter for whomever might buy it one day. And so I drove up to see Jeff, who had left Charleston, was now in Greenville, South Carolina. And I said, let's take this national. And he was like, great. If you want to do the business side, be CEO, I want to focus on my strengths, which is, you know, building the products, the R&D, obviously kind of being the heart of the brand and everything, kind of where we stand, what we stand for, Georgia Boy Chef. The red clay is actually named after the red tinted clay like dirt of Georgia. He grew up on a watermelon farm outside of Atlanta, or in Atlanta, but his grandfather was a watermelon farmer and he would spend a lot of time on the farm. So that's, you know, Babyators did not need me in the day to day. I felt at that point my team was really running and I did not want to be a micromanaging CEO looking over their shoulder at the Instagram caption of the day. And so stepped aside to kind of really kind of grow Red Clay from the ground up to scale it nationally and then eventually one day sell it.
Oh my gosh. And that portion of the journey for Red Clay was in 2018, that conversation with Jeff of let's go national.
Yep.
Oh my gosh, Molly, this is so fun. This is so fun to unpack every little entity. And I love too that you're open with, this is likely the goal. Let's grow this thing. And for you to have such a juxtaposition between the two entities, I mean, it just goes to show so much about you and your personality and your brain and just the brilliance that you come with as a CEO, as an entrepreneur, and as a co-founder for these different entities. Oh my gosh. So since then, you guys do the most incredible events. I mean, every time I see you on Instagram or if I hear about what you're up to, it seems like you guys are doing the most creative events. And oftentimes they're not ones I would necessarily pair hot sauce with. So I just wanted to take a moment to let you know, I really feel like you're breaking down barriers and boundaries of what people think within a food or kind of the food and beverage realm of what you can and can't do. Do you sense that at all? Because I do.
Oh, thank you. I think that means a lot. I think for me, I view, a couple of different things there that come to mind. You know, your business, your role, your job should bring you joy, right? Think, you know, if we're going to be working this hard to build businesses, why not do things that actually are true and authentic to you? And as a consumer of, you know, there's so much out there, there's so much noise, there's so much to buy. And I find I gravitate towards brands that are authentic, right? That tell the brand story well, that show the people behind it, show the humanity behind it, are a little playful, a little tongue in cheek, but also, you know, true to who they are. Yeah. And so for me, you know, a lot of the events I organize around sort of like empowering sort of female leaders or having events where sort of bringing female entrepreneurs together, that's sort of my side, my truth of the portion of Red Clay. And then we also have a very kind of foodie focused side to our events, which is very much Jeff of like, all right, let's make sure we're supporting the local food festivals. Let's have a delicious chef dinner. Let's go out on an oysterman's boat and talk about the local oysters with some key people in this city and create awareness about the oyster culture here. It's kind of where Jeff and I meet as this odd couple, you know what I mean? I'm in New York City, you know, intense Yankee businesswoman, and then a Southern Georgia boy chef with two very kind of distinct passions bringing together and making a beautiful brand. But I do believe all product-based businesses are more and more evolving into lifestyle brands. And as much as a business owner, you can think about what does your brand look like on a podcast? What does your brand look like in an in-person event? What does it look like in a gift basket? What does it look like on a website? What does it look like on an email, on an Instagram post? They all need to feel consistent and true and dynamic and interesting, and something, who is your consumer and how are you reaching them?
You know, I really wish we had 2 hours today because I'll
be back whenever you need me, Emily.
Oh, you're the best. I mean, this is just incredible. And to have been able to run through fairly quickly your career in this way and to unpack, okay, this season, and now ultimately the season that you're in, which is really beyond inspiring to me and I know to my listeners as well. But I can't let you go without asking this question. Very curious to hear your thoughts. What would you say is perhaps the greatest lesson you have learned?
The greatest lesson I've learned, I would say, in business and entrepreneurship in particular, is that it is a marathon, not a sprint, right? And there is no one decision that is going to make or break your company. It is about a commitment to get up and do the work day after day, week after week, month after month. Stay nimble, stay agile, attuned, be willing to pivot, flex. You're not kind of going down with the ship of one decision that might not work, and adjust and know there's always another day to get it right. And it's not that, you know, oh my gosh, preventing bad things from happening because they're going to happen. It's how you handle the bad things when they happen and how you overcome them with your team. And it is perseverance. And that's really, I think, what makes or breaks a successful business or a long-term, like how a small business can thrive over time or take it to an exit. And you kind of made the point earlier about, it's interesting thinking about building this company to sell. And I'm actually in the middle of a book right now that I would highly recommend for any business owner called Finish Big, about thinking about your exit from day one. Wow. And this, even if you don't plan on selling, even if it's a family business that you want to give to your kids, things come up, you know, you have to adjust and you have to build a business thinking about those those elements that help make a business thrive, which ultimately are the attributes that a potential acquirer is looking for. And so it's a net positive to think about profitability, to think about margin, to think about the things that somebody who's looking at you from the outside to evaluate your business to buy it are ultimately what makes a small business grow and exist and continue to thrive over time. And so we give everyone our team profits interest who joins Red Clay. I want everyone with an owner's mindset to have a little bit of skin in the game and to be able to celebrate when we do sell and not be scared of their job security or whatever, but you know, excited about a nice check. So I want everyone on my team to read this book and have a little kind of book party about it. Yes. And so I'd love to talk about it with any of your listeners out there who want to read it too.
Oh, fabulous. Well, thank you. And the theme too, not only perseverance, but the theme throughout this conversation for me personally is a real lack of fear. And obviously that's a good thing. There's a fearless element to you, your personality, your story that I'm going to hold on to when I need it and take that encouragement. So very cool. That's definitely a theme that I'm sensing as well. Well,
and I think for me, you know, one point about that, you know, yeah. When you asked about what's the most important thing I've learned, there's the business thing, which I just shared. And I would say on a personal level and just bigger, larger truth for life, yeah. It's okay to be vulnerable. It's a, you know, first of all, love and relationships and the humanness, human connection is more important than anything else. And Jeff and I talk about that with our business. We are about human relationships. We're not about hot sauce. The way we treat one another, the way we treat ourselves, the way we take care of our families, the way we take care of our vendors, our partners, our team. It is about human connection. And as a result, it is about showing and sharing all your feelings, right? And so I think it's, you know, we talked about the great female friendships. Those grew when I was able to be vulnerable with them. Those grew when I was able to show my anger or my fear or my sadness or my moments where I'm doubting myself and could lean on them. Because, you know, the one note, yay, I'm successful. Yay, I'm perfect. Yay, I'm happy. First of all, that's boring. Second of all, that's inaccurate. Thirdly, like, it's nobody wants to be near that, right? Like, and so I feel like, yes, it's feeling the fear and facing it anyway. It's feeling the fear and knowing if you actually walk into the fear, it's going to dissipate. Everyone has the fear. Everyone has doubts. Everyone has, oh my God, am I going to do this? Oh my God, is our business going to survive? I think about COVID when we had, you know, $1 million goal for the year. This was 2 years ago, 2020. And 300 grand of it was restaurant revenue and all the restaurants closed in March.
Oh my gosh.
We didn't know where we were going to make up for that. And it was scary, you know, and we had 3 months of cash in the bank. So immediately we expedited a capital raise. And then we also pivoted and started gifting all these celebrity chefs at home, knowing they were cooking at home since they weren't out at their restaurants. And a few days later, Jenna Bush Hager received a box and held it up in front of Hoda on the Today Show saying, just received these for Mother's Day. They're getting me through my quarantine. And when we had, you know, we turned around thinking, oh no, I can't sleep at night because we're not going to meet our numbers to, it was a $45,000 day. And oh no, I can't sleep at night because we don't have enough product to sell to Jenna Bush's, you know, audience. And
oh
so, it, you know, the pivot of I'm scared, that's okay. I'm going to get up and I'm going to do the work, but acknowledge the fear, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's both and.
Oh my gosh. Okay. There's always a well, not always. There are oftentimes pause and rewind moments, and I love to share them with my listeners. This is it, you guys. Pause, stop listening to me, rewind, listen to what Molly just said. And listen to it a couple times because I know I'm going to as well. Well, Molly, I know you always have something fun coming up. What's next for you?
Well, right after this, today we are launching a collaboration with a local candle maker here in Charleston, and we are doing a sort of a summer in the South smell beautiful farmer's market candle, and it's tomato and basil and geranium, and that launches today, a limited edition candle, and I'm headed to a candle making class with 10 girlfriends to celebrate the launch of the candle, and that is in 20 minutes, which I'm really excited about.
Amazing.
And then I think bigger picture, you know, we've is just sort of continuing this growth of Red Clay. We've got 3 or 4 more years till I can get to that kind of 20 million in revenue sweet spot where we're interesting to the big players. Wow. And so it's again back to just like getting up and doing the work day after day and enjoying the journey so that I don't turn around when it's all over and be like, wait, what just happened?
Yes.
I want to be present.
Oh my gosh. Well, it's amazing. It's amazing. And congratulations in advance on all of the success you've seen and all that's upcoming as well. Molly, is there anything we didn't cover that you'd like to?
No, I mean, this is wonderful. So happy to be here. And it's an honor.
Thank you. Oh, well, thank you. And thank you so much for your time. I'd love to know too, because I know within the theme that we've been chatting about, friendships, relationships, who do you know that should maybe come on and share their story?
I think of one of my favorite female CEOs, Denise Woodard of Partay Cookies. If you have not met her yet. But she also, she was one of the speakers at C-Summit. She could not make it in person because she was being interviewed for the sort of, I actually think for the Today Show as well. She is a phenomenal leader and a real product maven. She comes from about a decade in the kind of Coca-Cola, Pepsi world beverage corporate, and then left when her daughter developed food allergies to start this sort of cookie brand free of the major 8 or 10 allergens out there for kids. And it has skyrocketed. And I want to say Jay-Z's invested and Rihanna's invested. And, it's very cool. She's one of my favorites, a mentor and a friend. And I'm happy to connect you guys.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much, Molly. And you all will have to be on the lookout for a potential episode with Denise. And Molly, I know many ladies have already found you on Instagram. I'm sure they're over at Red Clay Hot Sauce, checking out purchases and what they might enjoy. But where can listeners connect with you?
I mean, Instagram for sure. My personal one is just at Molly Feening. And then Red Clay Hot Sauce is our businesses.
Oh, amazing. Molly, thank you. Thank you so much for your time today. This was such a treat. Thank you all for listening to today's episode of How'd She Do That? Sponsored by LBH PR Co. I am Emily Landers. You can follow me on Instagram and the podcast at How'd She Do That Podcast. We hope you'll join us next Tuesday for a new episode. We will talk to you soon.